focused on the facts. Chris Smith on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to the second hour of the program. Plenty more to get to. I'm going to catch up a little bit later with Professor James Allen from the University of Queensland. One of the things I wanted to talk to the professor about was immigration. We spend a lot of money getting people out here. We spend a lot of money processing them to stay here. And then we think that, oh, the revenue from so much immigration, and we've had a record number in the last 18 months, the revenue is worth it because, you know, it's fantastic for the coffers and the budgets look great. Well, is any of that true, or is it just bunkum, the kind of stuff you hear from governments all the time, because they're only trying to get new arrivals in here so that they can secure their vote for life? And if you're a new arrival and a particular government got you into the country, gave you a new life, you're going to vote for them forever, right? Well, I wonder whether that's the case. I'm going to talk to Professor James Allen about it. Now, one topic on immigration that has occurred today has been a full-page advertisement in some of our newspapers in Australia. It comes from Dick Smith, who's always had a problem, and I've spoken to him on this program about the fact that there's no plan for immigration. And there is no plan for immigration. It's willy-nilly. We certainly don't tailor our immigration program to bring in people we need to fill the gap in certain industry sectors. We don't do that. And you would have thought that should be priority number one, but we don't do that. So it says, I'm running ads, says Dick Smith on X, in The Australian, The Daily Telegraph and Sydney Morning Herald this week. I believe it's important our leaders tell us where we will end regarding population growth. Good luck, Dick. Most people agree that we should have a plan. It's not too much to ask, is it? It will be interesting to see if we get any reaction. I have a feeling this particular federal government has no plan because they have no idea how to run that system. They have no idea how to run an appropriate immigration system because they can't say no to some people. They're too lovey-dovey. Let's bring everyone in. No. Don't worry about their qualifications. Oh, you mean they might be on welfare for the rest of their lives? Don't worry. Bring them in. That's what we've got. But what we should have is a tailored clinical approach to immigration where we go, hold on a second, we need plumbers. Let's go and get some plumbers from India, et cetera, et cetera. That's what we should be doing, but we don't. We need something like, I think it's 300,000 tradies in the next month to fill the jobs that are available. We're not going to get them because we don't tailor our immigration properly. So he's written in this ad, this is how it goes. Prime Minister and Premiers, what's your population plan? Now, why hasn't any journalist asked that question today of the Prime Minister? I haven't heard that that's happened. You would have thought someone should have. You would have thought they were smart enough to do so. Or is that not something we mention because it's anti-immigration? It might be racist. Is that it? Well, we go all weak at the knees when we have to talk about immigration. The topic's too hard for journalists in Australia. What's your population plan? Fair question. It says our original Australians lived here for 60,000 years with a population of never more than 1 million. The First Nations people clearly knew there was a limit to growth in this finite land. Prime Minister and Premiers, do you too believe there is a limit to growth? Every Australian family has a population plan. They can have up to 20 children in their lifetime, but none do. They wisely have the number of children to whom they can give a good life. In most cases, he's right. Prime Minister and Premiers, how many people can Australia give a good life to? They wouldn't know that. No one's done the hard work. No one's done the homework or the due diligence. Where do you think? 30 million, 100 million or a billion people? Are we okay with that? Where is the extra fresh water, food and power to come from? And then at the end is Dick Smith's Fair Go website, which you can go to right now, by the way, dicksmithfairgo.com.au, dicksmithfairgo.com.au. I'm so glad that he published that this week. And I hope people read it and understand how much our politicians have fallen short on promising a plan for immigration. There is none. There is none. They're not that smart. Okay. The rideshare industry, which of course used apps instead of more traditional methods for ride hailing, is finding it tougher than they thought to make a buck. Uber, was forced to pay out $178 million to Aussie cabbies over lost income by the cab industry. Now, according to Computer Daily News, it's currently being sued by rival app GoCatch, which claims it used underhanded tactics to destroy its rival. And now rival rideshare group Ola, O-L-A, is shutting down its operations in Australia, New Zealand and the UK 6 years after expanding to international markets. Ola says it will concentrate its resources on the Indian market instead. Now, the Ola spokesperson said, with this clear focus, we've reassessed our priorities and have decided to shut down our overseas ride-hailing business in its current form in the UK, Australia and New Zealand. That's from Ola. In other words, what Uber is doing is underhanded. They're trying to corner the market. They're trying to win the market over entirely for themselves. Where is the ACCC when you need them? This is Chris Smith on TNT.
It's the stuff.
It's that division
people are talking about.
And that cluelessness that they want to push.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, you can be part of the conversation. Do not hold back just because I've got a guest on or we're talking about heady issues. I'm sure you can partake in those heady conversations. Just do so from the United States or Canada on 1-888-201-6425, from the UK 033-0024-1026, or from Australia and New Zealand, it is 1-800-670-310. Well, in a dramatic development on the eve of Julian Assange notching up 5 years in Belmarsh prison, US President Joe Biden made a surprising revelation on Wednesday that the United States is considering dropping its legal pursuit of Julian Assange. Now, he said this after a question was asked. I don't know whether it was a Dorothy Dixer, so planned by, you know, the Biden camp to try and address the issue without making it the main part of his press conference with the Japanese leader. I don't know whether it was that or whether it was simply a random question that he answered, but I have been told that Stephen Conroy, the former communications minister in the Labor government, has said today that he knows, and he would know, that there are talks at the highest levels between America and Australia right now about Julian Assange. Maybe there's a link between what he has heard and what Joe Biden has said. Let's just hope there is that link and that they're getting to some kind of resolution to this matter. My next guest is following this development closely, as you'd imagine. David McBride is an Australian whistleblower. He's got a lot of time for Julian Assange, as you can imagine. In 2011 and 2013, he served in Afghanistan as a military lawyer to the Royal Australian Regiment and Australian Special Forces, respectively. David made information on war crimes committed by Australian soldiers, allegedly in Afghanistan, available to the ABC. Now, this embarrassed the Defence Force and the Australian government, and they pursued charges against David. If convicted of the charges against him, David McBride faces many years in prison. His sentencing date is scheduled for the 6th of May. It was originally scheduled for the 13th of March. David McBride, welcome back to TNT.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for having me on.
Now, can I just clarify something? You have been convicted, right? Because you have pleaded guilty.
That's right. I've already been convicted.
Yeah. Are you hopeful that the United States will drop its legal pursuit of Julian Assange? And President Biden made his comment with sincerity. Do you believe what we've heard?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's exciting. I think you're right. It's good to have someone who's a bit more astute than the average media person. You're right about, was it a Dorothy Dixer? Had they planned, had it been an unplanned question, I don't think, you know, Biden would have just not answered it. It does sound like they wanted the question asked and that they put it out.
Yeah, because Biden notoriously, when he's asked something off message at particular press conferences, he stutters. He doesn't know how to answer a question he hasn't been briefed
on. That's right. He would have laughed and he wouldn't have given an answer like that unless he was expecting it, I don't think. And maybe to buy time, but normally it was a bit like when they had dropped the prosecution of Bernard Collaery. And Dreyfus, Mark Dreyfus, was asked about it beforehand, and he said something like, "Were you taking this seriously?" And you know, then the politician, it's very hard for them to backflip once they say something like that. You know, that it usually means that they will follow. Something is going to happen.
What it also means, and I should sort of fill people into the way these things work, and I've got many, many former colleagues that work in the federal parliamentary sphere. When you've got someone like Joe Biden mentioning that they're talking about dropping charges, you do that to fire something out into the open to see how it's reacted, to see how stakeholders are reacting, to see how the press reacts, to see how radio talkback callers react, and to get a gauge for where the editors of the major newspapers are sitting. And so this could be just a weather vane out there, a finger in the air to work out where the wind is blowing. And if there is positive reaction to what he said in the last 24 hours, well, they go through with it.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's a very astute comment. And again, it's good. It's so good for me to hear people like yourself who can see behind the headlines. I think that that's exactly right. They're probably doing polling. They've probably got focus groups and probably studying the reaction now. It's also scientific modern politics. It's not it's not made up on the spot. It's very professional. Yeah, there's probably exactly as you said, it was to gauge reaction. We've already got quite a few people in, you know, 86, I think, members of parliament that in Australia that vote, which is a big amount, including the prime minister who voted at least that something should happen. Quite a few important people in the US making noises now. So, yeah, maybe they think that there is enough in it. But you're right. There could be it's a big backlash. Maybe he'll think again. But
there is supposition about which way America could go with this. Let's just say that Julian was told he needed to plead guilty to a lesser charge and never to step foot back in America again, which I think is the way they'll go. They won't let him off scot-free. Do you think Julian will accept that deal?
That's a good question. I think he was offered a deal before where he had to give up his source for the Democratic National Congress emails, and he didn't take it.
That's different, though. Credit. Journalists don't do that. Yeah, we go to jail for that.
Yeah. I know, I think that's good. But I think now, yes, he would take a – well, I'm just guessing, of course, but I think you would take a plea to a lesser charge if he's allowed to go free and allowed to keep talking. He's obviously, I don't think he's ever going to get set foot in America.
But now, in a statement made to ABC's Radio National, Defence Industry Minister Pat Conroy welcomed President Biden's latest remarks on Assange. He said, "We think this has been going on for too long, and we've communicated that to both the United States and UK government. So I welcome President Biden's comments," which is another interesting move. It's time to let this bloke go, surely, David.
You would have thought that none of the information was false. It was all true. It was embarrassing. And hopefully they can put it behind them and just say, we will do better next time. But it's a bad precedent. He's clearly not a terrorist. He's clearly someone who was concerned with the rule of law. The information was given to him by operatives of the US government who didn't believe their government was doing the right thing. And he published it. So it is, and as everybody knows, Chelsea Manning has been free for a long time.
Yeah.
So it does seem unfair that Assange is still living in a cage. And I think if he died, and he can't be far off it, it would reflect badly on the US.
Well, you're not wrong. See, that's the other consideration. Let me take a break. I've got to do that. I'll come back with you. I want to find out whether there's a connection between this development and your case, and we'll talk about your case in a little bit more detail. David McBride is with me at the moment. We'll take a break on TNT. We'll be right back.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. One reason people tune in to TNT Radio is often because they're loyal to a specific show or personality. Our personalities have been a part of people's daily routine, and people continue to tune in.
They trust TNT Radio
and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Without CO2, the world stops breathing.
CO2 sustains all life on Earth. Government, the WEF, and the elite believe humans are the carbon they really want to be rid of.
Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Okay, let's get back to David McBride. Would something, a decision in the next, say, let me think, a decision, say, in the next week or so, have any influence at all on your sentence, do you think, David?
I think it would, yeah. I think it would. People would say, well, if Julian Assange, the mother of all whistleblowers, is free, why are we putting David McBride in jail? It wouldn't be a lay down misère, but it would certainly be something. It'll be food for thought for people. So I'd be happy either way, I guess. And so it does seem a bit. We used to make jokes about it that it would be hard for Anthony Albanese to say ask Joe Biden to drop the Assange prosecution, and Joe Biden could say, "Well, you're trying to put David McBride in jail, so where's the parity?" But the security service as well. I mean, yeah, they would say it's different, but I don't see why it is different. It's the same sort of thing, same principle. Mm. But
so that's the 6th of May. So there are 3.5 weeks before that sentence. And if something were to happen, say, in 2 weeks' time on Julian Assange, it would put pressure surely on the judge. Now, I'm not trying to push you into saying that there's pressure on the judge, but I'm just observing that there must have been. There would be.
You would have thought, yeah. You would have thought.
Okay, I want to go back to your case. We had Shane Healy on the show yesterday. Shane is a former intelligence officer with the ADF. You know him well. He's had his own problems associated with his post-career trauma. We know that, and he's made that quite public, and we know his story. I have him on the program regularly to talk about intelligence and terrorism, et cetera, because that is his forte, and he analyzes things very well. He's taken issue with your release of the defense information that you passed on to the ABC. Here's part of his grievance against you.
My biggest issue, he chose to not say a word until at night he gave it. And it's interesting that it's retrospectively he's kind of saying, oh, I wanted to help people. The other issue, and this is my biggest issue, as someone who has a mental health charity, Pegasus Connections, where I now help use my, you know, I wound up in a mental health facility, and I now use that experience to help other veterans not go through that. And the Morrison government came out and called all of us war criminals. That has labelled us in the family court. We've lost marriages, we've lost jobs, we've lost self-esteem. What pride do I have for the 5 rotations I did in Afghanistan when my prime minister called me a war criminal? Mm. He hated that, and he has no empathy or compassion or acknowledgement that that's the mental injuries he's caused.
Your response, David McBride?
I decided not to really mention this individual by name or really respond. He's obviously a big hater. He's an ex-serviceman. I've got a respect for anyone who put on a uniform. He's damaged, as we all are. And I don't think I'm going to respond particularly to what he has to say.
But he made allegations that you had no thought for the people that were taken down, that were grouped in with those who were responsible.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's it's a good time to talk about the issue, and I'd rather just talk about the real facts than to get involved with this individual. I think he might become fixated on me, and it's a sort of thing that I worry about. One day he might try to harm me or my family. I do have a lot of haters at the moment. The truth of the matter is, I'm not a war crimes whistleblower. I did not say that war crimes have been committed at all. That's the story that Dan Oakes put out on the ABC.
What were you trying to determine then?
I was always against the leadership. I believe there were huge command failures, and the ADF had become a political instrument rather than a military instrument, and that we were defending, instead of defending the country, we were defending the minister's popularity.
Could you not have gone to one of the many units that investigate these things?
I went to all of them. I went to the AFP first in early 2014. They said, if the government wants to do something, it's not illegal. And anyway, you know, you'll have to go and see the military police on this. They didn't really understand what I was saying. I was saying we are doing sham investigations. So the first thing I was complaining about was to say, we are investigating soldiers who have done nothing wrong. And we are doing that. Well, I didn't know it at the time. I now think the reason we were doing that is we were covering up for some serious breaches, which had actually happened in 2012. And in 2013, they were therefore putting out these sham investigations, informing the media, as you know, a sort of sophisticated public affairs process where they were saying, look over there, don't look over here. So I was actually, despite what haters think, I was actually standing up for soldiers, special forces soldiers, who'd done nothing wrong. Although it was really the larger legal principle to say, what sort of an organisation puts innocent soldiers in jail, soldiers who have sacrificed a great deal in order to protect either the minister's reputation or possibly other bad soldiers who they know have done wrong things but are too famous to bring down.
Okay, one last question. But did you think that Dan Oakes would run the alternative line on the story? Didn't you think that that may have happened?
No, it was Dan Oakes is a complete phony in that there was no evidence of war crimes in the documents I gave him. All the inquiries said nothing to see here. Now, that may have been the inquiries may have been badly done. We don't know. But actually, it was a huge beat up, and the government wanted it out there. The government helped Dan Oakes because they wanted to push the bad soldier story rather than the bad general story. I was after the generals. I've always been after the generals. The government wants to blame it all on the soldiers. So that's the way it is. That's the facts in my case will actually be made public in about 3 weeks' time.
Yeah.
While I'm my haters, I've got haters on both sides. You know, the ABC say if you're actually after the government, they say, oh, what, you support war criminals, do you? Which is not the case. I support the law. But investigations have to go along certain lines. And if they don't, illegal investigations are not proper investigations. And the fact of the matter is I was actually standing up for soldiers or the law, not trying to put soldiers down, but the story was painted in quite a dishonest and disreputable way by the ABC, who are really just the 7:30 report, who, like Four Corners, are really just pushing the government line.
Yeah. We've discussed that before, and I think that's plain to see. Now, just one last one before we let you go. On your X page, you have a reference to AI pictures of you put together by anonymous account. What's happening here? Are they replicating your?
I've got a lot of very vicious haters, and I've learned this. This is why I don't want to engage the individual. If you make a smart-ass comment about someone, they tend to come back even harder. Sometimes they've even said totally disreputable things about my children and I, and which is absolutely outrageous. But yes, I have people now online who actively
they're copying your account.
Yeah, well, yes, they've got sort of statements with that looks like people, me, and voices saying things about.
I've had that on Facebook for about 25 years as soon as Facebook started. So they do it, mate. You can't do anything about it.
I know. It's always
Facebook
good
and these places don't give a stuff.
It's always good to speak to somebody else who's a public figure like yourself, because it reminds you you're not the only one, and you've had plenty of hate in your time too, and you've had, you know, all about political machinations. So, yes, I don't feel so sorry for myself when I speak to you.
Yeah, don't worry, mate. I've
had plenty of it.
It all happens, but don't worry. Worst things have occurred. You'll face that on May the 6th, and then hopefully you'll be able to get on with your life after that.
Yes, well, I hope so. But anyway, I'm proud of what I've done. I'm proud of who I am. My children are proud of me, and whatever happens, I'll be proud to stand tall. The haters might not understand what I stand for. That is a shame. But I know what I stand for. And if anyone wants to find out, maybe read my book.
David McBride, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Chris.
Appreciate it.
Happy to be on your show.
Good on you. Thank you, David McBride there. Interesting. May the 6th is his date with justice. And we'll hear a lot about the items within the case that we haven't heard as yet, which will be interesting. Just in terms of Shane Healey, Shane will continue being an expert on my program. I've got a lot of time for Shane. I don't think he is the sort of person that would try and go out and get David McBride. He's got bigger and better things to do with his life than do that, and that's not the kind of person he is, by the way. That's worth saying. Let's get some news for you, and then a lot more to come on the program, including Professor James Allen from the University of Queensland, a fascinating fellow. We're talking immigration right here on TNT.
Big news.
A story which contains more than first meets the ear.
TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. The Australian Labor government, under Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, plans to introduce direct economic interventions to foster local manufacturing and develop sovereign green energy supply chains in Australia. Three sons of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh were killed in an Israeli airstrike in the Gaza Strip, as confirmed by both the Palestinian group and Haniyeh's family. The Israeli military, acknowledging the strike, identified the three as members of Hamas's armed wing.
Are you enjoying listening to TNT Radio?
Do you think we're doing a good job?
Then please let us know. Why not leave us a like or a positive review or comment on Facebook, Gab, or Getter? Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Hey, good to have your company. We're on the home stretch as we head up to the news in about 26 minutes from now. And Sonia Poulton coming to you from the UK after the news. Well, as the federal government has this open door policy, it seems, when it comes to immigration, there are serious concerns, and understandably so, that the record numbers are a recipe for societal disaster. How do we find accommodation for hundreds of thousands of additional families, especially rental accommodation? There's virtually none. I think the vacancy rate at the moment is 1.2 to 1.5%. How do we possibly afford the welfare bill required to pay those who can't find work? Because we haven't handpicked those who are coming into the country. We've done it willy-nilly. And how do our hospitals, schools, and infrastructure keep up with the numbers as well? That said, we keep hearing many economic commentators say, oh, it's inevitable. We need more immigrants if we want to continue our productivity and revenue base. So what's the truth? I'm confused, and no doubt you are as well. Professor James Allen is the Garrick Professor in Law at the University of Queensland. Before arriving in Australia in February of 2005, he spent 11 years teaching law in New Zealand at the University of Otago, and before that lectured law in Hong Kong. Professor Allen is a native-born Canadian who practiced law in a large Toronto law firm and at the bar in London before shifting to teaching law. He joins us now from Queensland. Professor James Allen, welcome back to TNT.
Thank you, Chris. So one step ahead of extradition, that's been my life story.
I was just about to say you've hop, skipped, and jumped from country to country. You're just one step ahead of the authorities. I'm glad. Yeah. That is good. Be very skeptical about government spending on immigration is one of your articles written recently for the Spectator magazine. What do you mean about being skeptical on government spending on immigration? What do we spend on immigration?
Well, so I come from a family of economists. I'm the black sheep as a lawyer. So the basic Keynesian model is that you want to increase gross domestic product. So all you ever hear about is GDP. GDP measures economic activity. It measures spending, and it includes government spending. And so two things happen. When government spends a lot, even if it's, you know, digging a hole and then filling it in again, that ups GDP. And when you, you know, if you're an island with 1,000 people and you bring 1,000 people in that year to live, almost by definition, gross domestic product goes up. Mm. The question is, how are you doing per person? So GDP per person. And Australia's not doing well. So, you know, we heard about all the great GDP, you know, 20 years without a recession. But in terms of GDP per person, Australia hasn't done any better than Japan, which has no immigration. We've had, in fact, I think in the last 10 to 12 years, we've had two GDP per person recessions. You mentioned productivity. Australia's productivity is terrible. You know, our productivity is not good. We have crazy labor laws. We're over-bureaucratic and we're over-centralized. Yep. So that's not good. And I think last year was the biggest drop in people's individual living standards in about, 20 years.
It was.
And so all they want to talk about is GDP, which is a, you know, it's not a worthless measure, but it's not a very important measure. And we have to not let politics. Now, I think partly is they're afraid not to keep bringing people in, because if GDP collapses and you get a recession, they're going to lose an election. So they need to explain to people that what's important is increasing productivity. That has the highest correlation with how people do in terms of wealth. And Australia's productivity is not good.
And so, exactly. You know, there was a time when governments spoke about growth and productivity ad nauseum. The likes of Peter Costello, for instance, used it to gauge where we were going as a country. Productivity, productivity. But we don't hear it as much nowadays, do we?
Because it's not good right now.
Yeah.
It's good. And so obviously they don't want to talk about it too much. I mean, the 2 years, let's be honest, the 2.5 years of COVID were a killer for young people, killer for poor people. I'll just come right out and say it. From day one, I was a lockdown skeptic. I think what we did was terrible.
Yeah.
We transferred money from the old, from the rich, from the poor to the old, from the poor to the rich, the young to the old. Sweden, which didn't lock down, clearly got everything right. You can see it from excess deaths. You can see it. There was just a study came out of Stanford a couple of weeks ago. Closing the schools in the U.S., they figure over the next couple of decades is going to cost the U.S. $81 trillion. If you were poor, some of those kids missed a year, 2 years of schooling. They will never make it up. Mm. You know, it's okay if you're a wealthy sort of Canberra family where the mom can stay home and teach the kids. They probably get a better education than in our public schools. But by and large, poor kids just lost 2 years of schooling. They will never make that up.
No.
You know, every decision made, it's looking was wrong. So no wonder productivity's down. We taught people they can get a whole bunch of money for doing nothing. Working from home, does anybody really believe that for most people, most of the time, working from home is as efficient and productive as working from the office? I don't believe that.
Of course not.
Of course not.
Of course not, in the majority of cases, of course
not. There's
not.
Always the author writing the next sort of J.K. Rowling book who works from home, but it's an exception. It's not the rule.
All right. The other topic I wanted to talk to you about was social science research surveys. They're grist for the mill here in what we do. You know, every second day we have a story that might say, you know, our young people fear that we're going to be lost in a nuclear war, or our young people are happier than they've ever been. Next week we find that our young people are miserable. What's the truth of these social science surveys? And I just wonder, from an article you wrote on this very topic, I wonder whether you can replicate these kinds of surveys, which can only prove that they might be accurate, but quite often they're not easily replicated, are they?
So if you start with the hard sciences are when you're looking at the natural world, right? So if you get this drug, does it work? Those sort of hard science things, nuclear physics. When you look at the top journals in the hard sciences, they are definitely having a replication crisis. Something like 50% of the studies that appear in the top level journals can't be replicated. Now, when you turn to social science, that means you're looking at human beings.
Yeah.
And often you're getting sort of questions about how people will behave or what they've done in the past. And yes, it's easy to be skeptical. I mean, you can have a big survey where they ask, you know, everybody, how many times did you have sex last week, Chris? And does anybody believe that you're getting honest answers? I mean, there's lots of reasons to be skeptical. Now, they try to control for all that. So I'm a little skeptical. But usually, if there's enough built-in statistical checks, they tell us something. And what I was writing about was a big study that came out. I can't remember off the top of my head, but they were looking at the democratic world and asking people, you know, how satisfied were they? How happy were they?
Right.
And, you know, there's a massive difference in the Anglo world, in the Anglosphere world, between oldies, 60 and over, I think it was 60 and over, and youngies, under 30. And oldies tend to be pretty happy, and youngies are very unhappy, comparatively speaking. And this is not true in the non-Anglosphere world. I mean, so Germans, the young are happier than the old. And, you know, it's easy to say, because again, I think we handled the lockdowns. It was thuggish. It was authoritarian. It's easy to say, you know, we've locked up kids in tiny little rooms for 2.5 years. Of course they're unhappy. And we've, you know, we've taken all their money through asset inflation and given it to old people, which we have. And I'm a conservative, but, you know, some of the things we did made me want to, you know, join the Communist Party. Mm. But that answer doesn't really work when you look at all the countries that had equally tough lockdowns, and this isn't true. I personally think maybe the answer has to do with the fact that in the Anglo world, our education system is teaching kids that their culture is not a good one.
Yeah, it is. I made that point very early in the program today. They teach that, you know, colonialism has wrecked the country,
right,
not advantaged people,
etc.
And so what we've got is people not proud enough to fly their flag, for instance. They see it as cringeworthy.
Right. No patriotism. You know, it's hard to imagine the young today doing what they're doing in the Ukraine. And the problem is most of it's factually wrong. Slavery existed everywhere in the world, but it was only in Britain where basically the sort of nonconformist Christians, the Methodists, sort of pushed the abolitionist line, that the Brits knocked out slavery in the Atlantic at a massive cost to their own economy. I mean, it was very expensive. No one else did that.
Mm.
Now, no one talks about it. No one says that the African slavery, I think all up, it was about 2% ended up in North America of slaves. Way more went to South America, the Caribbean, and the biggest number of slaves from Africa went to the Islamic world. Nobody talks about that. And none of those countries were stopping slavery. It was Britain. And, you know, they have a lot to be proud about. But no one teaches our kids any culture, any country is going to have done things in the past that, you know, you're not particularly proud about. But in terms of creating the most palatable, attractive societies on earth, well, that's the Anglosphere countries, Britain, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the U.S. There's a reason that 8 million people are trying to get into the U.S., and it's not because it's a hellhole. It's because it's one of the most attractive places on earth to live. And when you tell kids that there's no reason to feel proud about their culture and you only teach them the negative, well, it's not surprising they're not very happy. It's our fault. It's our generation who's done this. We've let the crazy woke lefties take over all the cultural institutions. No one does anything about it in the Liberal Party. The conservative politicians don't fight back. Mr. Trump fights back. And to some extent, the new Canadian opposition leader, Poilievre, looks like he's going to fight back. But, you know, it would be nice to see a backbone in some of our politicians.
Yeah, well, in the conservative side of politics, there aren't too many with backbones. One last topic. I wanted to get your insight into the government's plan, which has been shelved for the time being, to put the screws on social media platforms, the big tech giants, to crack down on misinformation and disinformation, to basically censor what we write and the opinions we express on social media. What concerns do you have about this approach?
It's a complete disgrace. This is the ACMA bill. And for your watchers, misinformation is where you supposedly are talking about something that's untrue. And disinformation is when you do that on purpose to try to mislead people on purpose. And I mean, the problem is on two levels. On the first level is people don't actually always know what truth is. It turns out if you listen to, and I think he's right, the world top 10 epidemiologist, Jay Bhattacharya from Stanford, when you look back now at what we were being told during COVID, he says the biggest source of untruth, of disinformation throughout the democratic world were governments. Now, this ACMA bill is going to exempt government. So nothing they say can be deemed to be disinformation or misinformation. And they have a very loosey-goosey sort of definition of harm. And you're going to be getting a bunch of sort of bureaucrat, and we know they're going to end up being left-wing people, deciding what's true and not.
Yeah.
Go back to The Voice last year. You know, I'm a constitutional lawyer, and they were running this sort of body out of RMIT saying, you know, everything they deemed to be untrue misinformation, I think was true. They just basically said everything the no camp is saying is misinformation. It was all true in my view. Now, sometimes you're in the realm of opinions. And if you have an opinion about what's likely to happen in 3 years, well, nobody can say if that's true or untrue. Right. You got facts, and even those are hard to know. And then you've got opinions about the future. And you've got these activists saying, oh, well, that opinion about what the judges are likely to do is untrue. No, it's not untrue. I think all the claims we made about activist judiciary were likely to be true. Nobody can know for sure.
Well, we didn't have a set plan on how it would work. Of course it was possible.
Of course it was possible. And so all of these bodies are just basically in the game of censoring, and you know whose views will be censored.
Yeah, the conservative side.
And again, even if this is a brutal sort of set of policies, it never actually accomplishes even what the left-wing activists want, because it drives dissent underground. And when you drive things underground, you know, you end up, people just assume that if government's saying it's not true, it is true. Again, you know, we're seeing this everywhere. John Stuart Mill, the great guy who wrote On Liberty, said the best way of getting at truth is to allow all opinions to be spoken and people compete in the marketplace of ideas. And we never know for sure, but we move towards truth in the cauldron of competing ideas. Or you can believe that a bunch of sort of 20-year-olds who advise governments and bureaucrats are likely to know what's true by, you know,
yes, intuiting. Because they're closer to God, you see. They're closer to God.
It's just garbage, Chris, and you know it, I know it.
Of course, can I just ask one thing, and this is my theory on all of this. Social media is a little bit like talking over to the back fence, as I do on a Saturday afternoon to Luigi. And it's sort of like the same thing as going up to the pub on a Saturday afternoon and talking to the bloke about the football and having a theory about who's bad and who's good on the football field. Who gives a stuff? It's social media. Do you think that people who use social media believe everything they see on social media? They should keep their noses out of it all.
I agree with that. Although, you know, during lockdown, some of the sort of most accurate sources was on social media. If it wasn't, you know, X, especially after Musk bought Twitter.
True.
I will say this before you go. The first iteration of this terrible ACMA bill was put forward by Christian Fletcher and the Liberal Party. You know, this is the disgrace. Now, it's worse now.
Yeah.
But the idea that a supposedly liberal government is in the game of censoring opinions, and we know they are, because look at what Morrison said. He said free speech never created a job, which is laughably false.
Yeah.
It's the competition of ideas that creates a vigorous capitalist society.
Yep.
So, you know, we have some terrible politicians on the right side of politics. They don't seem to believe in free speech even. And we, you know, Dutton's better. Morrison was terrible. And
Morrison was horrible. Yeah, exactly. I've got to leave it there. But, mate, thank you very much for your time. I'd love to have you on again, if I may, and take more of your time.
Sure. Sure. Thank you. We can have a beer sometime.
Yeah, let's do that. James Allen, thank you very much. Good on you.
Thank you.
All right, Professor James Allen from the University of Queensland. Hasn't he got a refreshing view of things that we're talking about on a regular basis and things that are coming up in the not-too-distant future, including this particular bill, misinformation and disinformation? Stop playing God. Get out of our lives. We don't need you. You're part of the government. Let's take a break. This is Chris Smith on TNT.
I'm Naheem Hines, professional football player and proud supporter of the Muscular Dystrophy Association. My mom was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy when I was 14, and I watched her struggle. but MDA helped her get the best treatments and care. And they also help kids like my buddy Ethan.
My name is Ethan and I'm 12 years old. Thanks to the Muscular Dystrophy Association and people like you, I have more hope than ever before. From day one, they've treated me like family at my local care center. MDA is the only one that funds over 150 care centers across the U.S. to help provide state-of-the-art care for adults and kids like me.
For over 70 years, MDA has been transforming the lives of people living with muscular dystrophy, ALS, and other related neuromuscular diseases. They fund the research for breakthrough treatments, care, and cures. And MDA provides support to thousands of families like mine and Ethan's in communities like yours. Thanks to MDA, kids and adults can live life to its fullest. Join us and learn more at MDA.org today.
I didn't ask to be thrown in the streets with nowhere to go, but I did ask for help, and Covenant House was there for me.
1 in 10 young adults will experience a form of homelessness this year. For these kids who didn't ask to be put in this unthinkable situation, Covenant House is there, providing hot meals, a safe place to sleep, medical care, and love.
They just really genuinely just wanted to help me succeed, and I'm succeeding.
To learn more, go to safeplacetosleep.org today.
This is the Chris Smith Show on today's News Talk,
TNT Radio.
I can't let this story pass us by without getting it into the show somewhere. From the Daily Skeptic in the UK, Will Jones has written a fantastic article, keeping up to speed with the lack of demand for electric vehicles in Europe. Now, we know what's going on in the United States. Demand has just fallen through the floor. You can try and legislate for people to buy cars, make them cheaper with subsidies and all that sort of stuff. They're just not practical in a big country like the US. People love their petrol, their oil-driven cars. That's just how it is. The bigger, the better. As many of our American listeners and viewers can attest. Well, the same thing's happening in Europe. Will Jones writes, sales of Volkswagen electric cars have plunged by almost a quarter in Europe as demand for battery-powered vehicles stalls, ho-ho, and buyers return to petrol. Now, the Telegraph has also carried this story. So it's not just a skeptic's view of the statistics. It's the Telegraph's view as well. Electric vehicle sales fell by 24% in the first 3 months of the year as high inflation and rising energy prices dampened demand. But what's also dampening demand is not just economic conditions. It's the fact that they're impractical if you leave and take off outside of a city. Globally, all of the electric sales at the owner of Audi, Skoda and Porsche dropped by 3%, while sales of combustion engine cars climbed 4% to nearly 2 million. Are we seeing the turnaround that we're going back to petrol-powered cars and turning our back on electric vehicles after a spike? I think that's what we're seeing. There was a spike after COVID. And now the spike has ended and the trajectory is going in the opposite direction in the United States and in Europe. In September, Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, pushed back a deadline to block new petrol and diesel sales in the UK from 2030 to 2035. You can bet your whole house on the fact that 2035 will be changed as well. It can't happen. You talk to the manufacturers in Europe, they say that can't happen. They will not be manufacturing that many electric vehicles to say to the UK car consumer, you've got to buy electric vehicles. Won't happen. Won't happen. So Rishi Sunak has gone against what Boris Johnson wanted to do and legislate this by 2030. He said, oh, we've got to push it out to 2035. But you can bet even a Labour government under Keir Starmer after the next election in the UK, he will be determined to try and keep the 2035 date, but he won't be able to do it when the manufacturers say there just won't be the cars made. Data suggests that demand for petrol cars is rising faster than for electric models in Britain as well. EV registrations were only 3.8% higher last month than they were a year earlier, according to figures, while petrol engine sales rose 9.2%, 10% rise in petrol-powered cars as well, and that's in the UK. So now we've got continents in the UK, we've got the United States, we've got Europe, where electric vehicle popularity has waned completely, static, stable, which is all well and good, But you've got to remember what the head of Toyota said around about 2 months ago. He predicted that electric vehicles would only make up 30% of the car market. And yet the Rishi Sunaks of the world and the Chris Bowens of the world, the climate change minister in Australia, are trying to make it 100%. Now, Chris Bowen hasn't picked a date as yet, but Rishi Sunak has, 2035. Not going to happen. They can talk about it as long as they want. They can have all the press conferences with all the green vehicles surrounding them and all the infrastructure they want. It's not going to happen. The manufacturers won't have it happen because they know that the consumer, 70% of the consumers want a petrol-powered car. That's what they know. Ask the head of Toyota. I doubt whether there are too many people on earth who would understand the car consumer like the head of Toyota would. Now, other quick things I wanted to tell you about. The Weekend Truth Festival. This is quite an interesting event going on in the UK. You should hear all about this. It'll feature speakers such as Katie Hopkins. Good on you, Katie. Kate Shimarani, Dolores Kale, Matt Letizia, Mark Atwood, David Clues, Allegedly Dave, Sovereign Pete, and many others. All of this across one weekend on the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of May in Workington. That's near the Lake District in the UK. All you need to bring is a tent, a sleeping bag. See, this is like Woodstock for truth tellers. And some good vibes would be handy as well, as food stalls, workshops, bushcraft, and amenities will all be provided on site. It'll all be there. For more information and to find out how to reserve your place at this festival, the Weekend Truth Festival, you can visit the website weekendtruthfestival.co.uk, .co.uk. But don't hang around because only a limited number of places are still available. So don't dilly-dally. Get on to this. Get your place in the Weekend Truth Festival, which is set down for the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of May, which is around about 3 weeks from now. Interesting to see what Senator Babette, Ralph Babette, has put on his Twitter posts today on X. He's got a photo of Anthony Albanese, the Prime Minister of Australia, in a turban. Now, this was recent because there was a Sikh festival and Anthony Albanese proudly wore a turban on his head. I don't have a picture of it for me, but you could just imagine. It was an orange and red turban, and he looked the part. He looked like a Sikh, which is so wonderful. But Ralph makes a really good point about what the Prime Minister tends to wear. He says, this is the man who does not wear an Australian flag pin on his suit jacket. No. But he's got no problem wearing a turban and celebrating the Sikh festival. It's a very interesting point, isn't it? Because I know Scott Morrison made it compulsory for his MPs to wear an Australian pin, which I thought was terrific. Just a small sign that they support their country, that they are an Australian. I thought it was a touch. Didn't change any policy, didn't make us a better country, but it was a good touch. Hasn't been followed by Anthony Albanese, and not often do governments copy what their opposition do, but it could have been copied, and it made sense to me that it would have been copied, but no. But he's prepared to wear the Sikh turban, but he doesn't wear the Australian pin. And he keeps persisting turning up to press conferences with the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander flag and the Australian flag. And I detest that because I think we should all be under one flag. That's not to say we should wipe out the Aboriginal flag or the Torres Strait Islander flag. They have their places, especially when those places are, you know, for those particular special days, National Day of Reconciliation, etc. Fly those flags with pride. Do it on Australia Day as well, as we commemorate how this country was established prior to colonial times. But don't do it when you're representing Australia and you're trying to speak to one people. We're one people under one flag. We even sing it in our national anthem. But we don't have the Prime Minister symbolise that. He has three flags behind him. He did it from day one. I think it's wrong. I think it's wrong. I think it divides people into separate groups. We should be one group. That is the Australian group under one flag, the Australian flag. You may have a view on that. I'm happy to talk about that on any occasion, on any day on this program. I've run out of time. Sonia Poulton coming to you from the UK right after the news, and I'll be back to do it again one more time for the week. Look forward to your company. Tell your friends and family, come on down and check out The Chris Smith Show right here on TNT.